Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine, May 2022 edition. Slaughter in Seven Rivers by James B. Mills. Billy Wilson and Tom Pickett escape the noose for the senseless murders of four Hispanos in Lincoln County. Where would we get help if it weren't for the Mexicans? These were the words Billy the Kid Bonney said to Billy Wilson, Tom Pickett, Charlie Bowdery, Tom Folliard, and Dave Rudabaugh when they were being pursued by Lincoln County Sheriff-elect Pat Garrett's posse in the winter of 1880. After Tom Folliard and Charlie Bowdery were shot and killed, the Kid and his remaining associates were taken into custody by Garrett and his posse at Stinking Spring on December 23, 1880. Pickett faced charges for rustling in Las Vegas, while Bonney, Wilson, and Rudabaugh were escorted to Santa Fe. Tom Pickett was released on bonds and skinned out. Billy Wilson was convicted of counterfeiting and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. Dave Rudabaugh was convicted for the murder of jailer Antonio Lino Valdez and sentenced to death. William Bonney was sentenced to hang before famously escaping jail in Lincoln and being shot down by Pat Garrett at Fort Sumner on July 14, 1881. Dave Rudabaugh and Billy Wilson also escaped jail less than a year after their convictions, albeit in a less spectacular fashion. Although Rudabaugh fled the territory, never to be seen again, Tom Pickett and Billy Wilson showed up again in Lincoln County with grievous consequences. While their old rustling companion William Bonney remained a heroic figure among much of the Hispano populace in eastern New Mexico territory, Billy Wilson and Tom Pickett demonstrated an egregious lack of affinity in La Gente, the people, when briefly becoming a headline story themselves after participating in a shameful quadruple murder on Tuesday, January 8, 1884. Mexicans massacred, the Las Vegas Gazette announced 2 days later. It was an appropriate headline, with the newspaper accurately describing the incident as one of the most revolting chapters in the history of New Mexico bloodshed. When a contingent of Hispano laborers building adobe and digging an aquina in Lower Pecos Valley had run out of supplies on January 8, 1884, nine of them set out for Seven Rivers to purchase what they needed to finish their work. The party included Los Jojitos resident Regino Gutierrez, La Estrellita's residents Malcuidadas Flores and Sisto Gutierrez, Los Colinos residents Zaval and Enarcion Gutierrez, along with Teodoro Ulibarri out of Las Cueza, Juan Lermo from Corpus Christi, Texas, and Puerto de Luna resident Juan Roival, who had assisted Pat Garrett's posse in the winter of 1880. None of them were armed while peacefully heading toward a small placita village in Seven Rivers. Billy Wilson and Tom Pickett, former members of Billy the Kid's notorious gang, as the Las Vegas Gazette described them, were riding with two wrestlers called Pony Williams and Yank Beal. They had spent several days hanging around Bill Griffith's saloon and draining a large supply of whiskey bottles. Wilson, Pickett, and Beal were enjoying some more libations when Pony Williams spotted the nine Hispano laborers approaching outside and stuck his head through the saloon door. "There's a gang of greasers coming up the road," Williams told his companions. "Let's have some fun with them." Billy Wilson, Tom Pickett, and the rest of their intoxicated gang quickly ran outside and began readying their Winchester rifles and Colt revolvers. The drunken quartet then charged toward the nine Hispano laborers and opened fire on them. In a hail of unprovoked bullets, Juan Roival shouted at his co-workers to run for it. The unarmed Hispano laborers quickly scattered as Wilson, Pickett, and their companions continued firing dozens of shots at them. But only Juan Roival, Regino Gutierrez, Saval Gutierrez, Encarnacion Gutierrez, and another hombre managed to escape with their lives. Sisto Gutierrez, Teodoro Ulibarri, Juan Lermo, and family man Melquiades Flores lay soaked in their own blood, either dead or dying. Two of them had been gunned down instantly while the others were shot in the back while running for cover. The five surviving Hispanos took shelter behind some adobe walls before fleeing into the mountains and heading north. The whiskey-soaked murderers merrily returned to the Griffith Saloon and demanded more drinks. The howling, bloodthirsty rustlers seemed to glory in the slaughter of the four natives and took their time leaving Seven Rivers, the Las Vegas Gazette reported. Billy Wilson, Tom Pickett, Pony Williams, and Yank Beal then rode south for the Mexican border after carrying out one of the most blood-curdling crimes ever recorded in frontier history, as the St. Louis Globe-Democrat described it. Melquiades Flores, Sisto Gutierrez, Teodoro Ulibarri, and Juan Lermo were buried in a single grave by some of their amigos in La Cuesta, modern-day Villanueva. Governor Lionel A. Sheldon responded to the slaughter by issuing a public proclamation that was printed in the St. Louis Globe-Democrat on January 15, 1884. "Now, therefore, I do hereby offer a reward of $300 for the capture and conviction of the murderer or murderers of each said murdered parties, to be paid out of territorial funds, on proof of capture and conviction of such murderer or murderers. Done in executive chambers at Santa Fe, January 11th, 1884. Seal, Lionel A. Sheldon, Governor of New Mexico, by the Governor, W.G. Rich, Secretary." News of the murders was reported by newspapers as far east as Pennsylvania and Connecticut. The Santa Fe, New Mexican, announced on January 12, 1884, that the total reward for the capture of the gang is $2,000, which is $500 in the case of each man who fell victims to the cold-blooded fun. As far as the Las Vegas Gazette was concerned, Pat Garrett was the man for the job. It only remains for Garrett to go on the warpath again and do up Pickett and Wilson, the newspaper declared on January 10th. It was widely reported that a posse of Lincoln County citizens had pursued Billy Wilson, Tom Pickett, Yank Beal, and Pony Williams until they eluded capture by crossing the Rio Grande. "No arrests have been made yet," reported the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, Utah, on January 19, 1884. The motive of the killing was pure cowboy deviltry. Lincoln County Sheriff John W. Poe was engaging in damage control when writing to Governor Lionel Sheldon. His letter was soon published in the Lincoln County Leader on February 23, 1884. "I suppose some of the papers have given you the impression that our county is in a terrible condition, overrun with thieves and rustlers again, etc.," Sheriff Poe wrote. "I assure you that is not the case. Lincoln County is more orderly and peaceably now than it has ever been." Poe then tried to deny that the murders had even occurred. "Billy Wilson and Tom Pickett have not been in this county for nearly 3 years. There has not been four men killed in this county in the last 18 months. I am at a loss to know what the motives of parties circulating reports of crime in Lincoln are, unless they envy the county's prosperity and peace." While Lincoln County was enjoying more peaceable days prior than in 1884, the grisly murders were being swept under the rug. Billy Wilson, Tom Pickett, Yank Beal, and Pony Williams were never captured. Tom Pickett eventually got married and fathered children in Arizona. He worked as a stage driver and became a deputy U.S. Marshal before exhaling his final breath in Winslow, Arizona, on May 14, 1934. Billy Wilson moved to Texas, became known as David L. Anderson, and eventually became the sheriff of Terrell County. Wilson, alias Anderson, also became friends with Pat Garrett. In 1896, the famed lawman helped broker a pardon for Wilson for counterfeiting when he wrote to New Mexico Territory Governor William T. Thornton, "I have since 1891 known Billy Wilson in Texas as D.L. Anderson, where he has enjoyed the reputation of being a good, honest, and straightforward citizen. I know of nothing he has done which would be discreditable to him since his escape. He is a man of family, all of which command the respect of all the people with whom they come in contact." Enjoying the benefits of Pat Garrett's favor, Billy Wilson never answered for the murders committed in Seven Rivers and received his pardon for counterfeiting from Governor Thornton. Billy Wilson, alias David L. Anderson, lived out the rest of his days until death came calling on June 4, 1918, and he was buried in Brackettville, Texas. "Where would we get help if it weren't for the Mexicans?" William Bonney's words to Billy Wilson and Tom Pickett had counted for naught on January 8, 1884, in Seven Rivers. So too had the lives of Melquiades Flores, Sisto Gutierrez, Teodoro Ubarri, and Juan Lermo when the territory's most famous lawman, Pat Garrett, helped secure his new pal, Billy Wilson, a pardon in 1896. No obria justicia. James B. Mills is a historian and published writer. He affectionately dedicates this article to his mother, Diane Mills. He resides in Australia and has spent much of his life researching the American West. His biography, Billy the Kid, El Bandido Simpatico, will be published by the University of North Texas Press in 2022. True West, May 2022 edition. The Earps Flight After the Fight by Johnny D. Boggs. The lawman's route from Arizona to New Mexico and Colorado is a grand adventure. The gunfight that wasn't at the OK Corral was over. Billy Clanton and the McClory brothers were planted in Tombstone, Arizona's cemetery, and there would be no murder trial facing lawmen Virgil, Morgan, and Wyatt Earp, or consumptive dentist gambler John Doc Holliday, for the most famous half-minute gunfight in Western history. But payback was hell. On December 28, 1881, just 2 months after the gunfight, Virgil Earp was badly wounded on the streets of Tombstone. On March 18, 1882, Morgan Earp was shot to death while playing pool with Wyatt at an Allen Street Saloon billiard parlor. Wyatt decided it was time to get the hell out of Dodge, Tombstone. The flight of the Earps began, but it was not your run-of-the-mill skedaddle. For a few days, in fact, it became a vendetta. Arizona. First, Wyatt, Doc, and his pals knew they needed to get Morgan's coffin and Virgil and family out of Arizona. That led them to Contention City, now little more than dust and memories, where the funeral cortege boarded a train to Benson Historical Museum, and from there to Tucson, Southern Arizona Transportation Museum. At the depot, the Earp family met up with Earp holiday-hating cowboys Frank Stillwell and Ike Clanton. The latter had the good sense to run. Stillwell fell dead from a load of lead. Wyatt's posse returned briefly to Tombstone, then journeyed on to Pete Spence's woodcutting place in the Dragoon Mountains South Pass. Spence had the good sense not to be there, but Florentino Indian Charlie Cruz was around and got shot dead. From there, at least according to legend, Wyatt kept traveling and shot Curly Bill Brocious dead at Iron Springs between Charleston and Benson. But John Bean, Cochise County Sheriff, and Wyatt Doc Enemy, and a cowboy posse were in pursuit. when Wyatt and Doc began their actual post-flight fight flights, less to avoid arrest and prosecution than to evade posses comprised of cowboy sympathizers who likely would help Earp and Holiday pass away through unfortunate accidents on their way back to Tombstone and eventual trial, says Jeff Gwynn, author of The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the OK Corral and How It Changed the American West. Wyatt and Doc were quite literally running for their lives. Wyatt and pals found respite on March 27th at Henry Hooker's ranch at Sierra Bonita, now a National Historic Landmark, less than 30 miles north of Wilcox, but still a working ranch and private residence. Bien wasn't about to attack the Earp gang and Hooker's bunch, so he led his posse away. New Mexico. Most of the Vendetta bunch scattered to parts unknown, Gwynn said. Wyatt and Doc reportedly landed across the New Mexico border in Silver City, Silver City Museum, selling their horses and traveling to Deming, Deming Luna Membres Museum. Both towns were booming. The Las Vegas Daily Gazette called Silver City strictly an American city, handsomely situated. Deming has 28 business houses covering all the various branches of business incident, two in which make a live town, Santa Fe's Weekly New Mexican reported. Eventually, the Vendetta boys then started moving north to Albuquerque, Albuquerque Museum, and Las Vegas, Las Vegas Museum. But not together. Wyatt and Doc split up. Says Gwynn, it's likely Doc had said something insulting, almost certainly anti-Semitic, about Josephine Marcus, Wyatt's lover. Doc bought property near the Las Vegas railroad tracks and opened a saloon and ordered new dental equipment for his new office on the plaza in Old Town, Victoria Wilcox writes in The World of Doc Holliday. He drank and bet more than he pulled teeth. He kept wandering. So did Wyatt. Colorado. Wyatt and brother Warren took the train to Trinidad, Colorado, A.R. Mitchell Museum of Western Art, where Wyatt's good friend Bat Masterson was marshal, says Bill Markley, author of Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, Lawmen of the Legendary West. Later in life, when a detractor was bad-mouthing Earp in a Denver saloon, Bat defended his friend, stating, "In all America, there is not a fairer, squarer, straighter man than Wyatt Earp," then added punctuation using his fists. Masterson's sympathy did not extend to Doc. In mid-May, Doc was arrested in Denver, and Pima County, Arizona, Sheriff Bob Paul arrived with extradition papers, Gwynn said. But Bat Masterson, more for trying to help Doc out of a friendship for Wyatt than for any real desire to assist the drunken dentist, who he hated, convinced the Colorado governor that Doc would never reach Tombstone alive. Doc was freed, and that pretty much ended any attempts by Arizona authorities to bring him and Wyatt back to face trial. Besides, in late May, Tombstone practically burned to the ground, and all official efforts there turned to rebuilding, not pursuing Wyatt and Doc. The Earps traveled to Gunnison, Gunnison Pioneer Museum, where they hired Arizona lawyers to handle their cases, Markley says, and Wyatt ran a faro game in one of the saloons. After that, Wyatt meandered around Colorado, Gwynn says, telling anyone who had listened that once he was pardoned, he'd go back to Tombstone and get everything settled. Meanwhile, Doc gambled in Pueblo, El Pueblo History Museum, Denver, History Colorado Center, and Leadville, Healy House Museum and Dexter Cabin. For a while, he eked out a marginal living as a gambler, sticking to Colorado towns, Gwynn says. He drank heavily and spent considerable time in jail. Doc ended up in Glenwood Springs, Glenwood Springs Historical Society and Frontier Museum. He tipped bellboys $1 a day to bring him whiskey, Gwynn says, before the dentist gambler died in a hotel room in 1887. He was 36. Wyatt eventually hit Alaska, Idaho, Nevada, and California, dying in 1929 at age 80. There's one happy twist to the story, Gwen says. Wyatt and Doc didn't remain permanently estranged. In May 1885, it said, and I believe, that Wyatt and Josephine met with Doc at a Denver hotel. Josephine would recount that the two friends spent 3 hours reminiscing, and as he told Doc goodbye, Wyatt had tears in his eyes since he was certain that Doc didn't have long to live and they'd never meet again. True West, May 2022 edition. Casper, Wyoming, by Peter Corbett. The historic trail town celebrates its Western heritage all year round. The College National Finals Rodeo in 2021 was not Casper's first rodeo. The central Wyoming city on the North Platte River, in fact, has hosted the collegiate finals for 2 decades in the Ford Wyoming Center. They call it the Rose Bowl of Rodeo, and it's the city's biggest annual event. Casper's Rodeo Week, June 12th through the 18th, will rope in 400 top rodeo athletes and thousands of visitors. Clarendon College of Texas grabbed the men's team championship last year. Montana State took the women's team championship. The local favorite, Casper College Cowboys, finished third. Tourists who show up in Casper in shorts and flip-flops can get properly attired for rodeo and other Western pursuits by visiting Lou Talbert Ranch Outfitters. The Western Wear store got its start in Laramie in 1917 and moved to Casper 30 years later. It carries saddles and tack and boasts of having 10,000 pairs of boots. They also have a robust collection of cowboy hats and an expert hat shaper on staff who can customize a hat to your head, said Amanda Sherlin, Casper Tourism Bureau Marketing Director. You can get fully outfitted there. It's just a fun place. The fun doesn't stop there in Casper. Locals are known to go sneak into the Beacon Club, a roadhouse restaurant and cowboy bar on the Yellowstone Highway. Other watering holes include the Backwards Distilling Company, the Gruner Brothers Brewing in the former Casper Oil Club, which got its start in 1949 as a place to do oil and gas deals over cocktails and steaks. Casper, nicknamed Oil Cunt City, has a history of black gold discoveries going back to early explorers in the region. By the 1880s, mineral claims were staked in what became the Salt Creek oil field north of Casper. In 1922, a Standard Oil refinery in Casper became the world's largest gasoline refinery, producing 615,000 barrels of fuel per month, according to the Wyoming State Historical Society. The city of Casper's name is derived from Fort Casper, built between 1865 to 67 for about 400 soldiers. The fort was named for Lieutenant Casper Collins, who was killed in an Indian raid near Platte Bridge Station, the fort's previous name. In naming the city and Casper Mountain, the city's founders misspelled Collins' first name. Visitors can learn more about the history of the North Platte River Valley at the recreated Fort Casper Museum. Immigrants on the Oregon, Mormon, and California trails traveled these routes for over 40 years, starting in the 1840s. These pioneers were on the trails for 6 months, walking 2,000 miles with their belongings packed on their wagons or hand carts. They hoped to reach Independence Rock, southwest of Casper, to ensure passage through the mountains before winter. Independence Rock, a 136-foot granite dome, is inscribed with thousands of immigrant names carved in the rock. The National Historic Trails Interpretive Center in Casper, now its 20th year, shares the history of immigrants who passed through on their way west. One of the center's exhibits gives visitors a feel for what it was like to ride in a Conestoga wagon as it lurched along the trail and through a river crossing. If that's not enough, outfitter Morris Carter of Historic Trails West has built replica wagons for trail tours of 2 hours to 5 days covering 55 miles to South Pass. We go over to Rocky Ridge, which is considered one of the roughest spots on the trail, Carter said of the longer trips. There's a section of each day that people walk beside the wagon or ride horses. Less rugged travelers may want to explore the trails via a National Park Service auto tour route, nps.gov. Where history meets the highway. Start here. Casper Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, 139 West 2nd Street, number 1B. Visit casper.com. Wagons Ho on the Trail. Learn about the Pioneer Caravan Experience at the National Historic Trails Interpretive Center, nhtcf.org. Rainy Day Destination. Nicolaysen Art Museum's Creating the West exhibit runs through April 16th. TheNIC.org. Take a hike, dude. See Garden Creek Falls and the Rotary Park at the base of Casper Mountain and hike the 5-mile Bridal Trail. Visit Casper.com. Dress the part. Get outfitted for ranching and riding the range at Lou Talbert's Ranch Outfitters, a downtown store that's been a Wyoming fixture since 1917. Lou, L-O-U, Talbert, TAUBERT.com. Peter Corbett moved west to Flagstaff in 1974 to attend Northern Arizona University, where he studied English and American Studies. He's been exploring Arizona and the West since then and had a 35-year career in Arizona journalism. True West, May 2022 edition. Daniel Boone's Yellowstone Hunt by Ted Franklin Ballou. Fact or fiction? Did America's first frontier hero reach the big sky land of geysers, scalding springs, and putrefied trees that John Coulter saw and old Gabe and Black Harris yarned about? Rumors abound of Daniel Boone's treks to Yellowstone and beyond, even to Idaho and the Pacific. Recent writers hinting off these far-off forays can be vague on details, creating hybrid revelations taken as gospel. 2 years past Boone's death's bicentennial, we will revisit the most credible of these stories, placing them in the setting of his trans-Mississippian realm that by 1820, when he was buried near La Charnette, Missouri, was already vanishing. 25 miles upriver from St. Louis Village, a bustling fur hub dominated by two French half-brothers, Auguste and Pierre Chartreux, and west of Alton, Illinois, Boone and seven families, a few of the enslaved, and a passel of livestock, forded the Father of Rivers into Spanish Upper Louisiana. Like Cumberland Gap to the east and South Pass to the west, this shallow oxbow of the Mississippi was destined to become the western portal for the thousands soon to tread in his wake. The year was 1799. Daniel Boone, at 65, was starting over. He and his wife, Rebecca, hied to 850 acres of fertile bottomland past the village with its beaver bales, hide men and motley Coeur de Bois, and over the Big Muddy from King's Road, New Spain's 40-mile hike back to St. Louis, to live with their son, Dan Morgan, at what is now Maston. Here, the paterfamilias acted as syndic, justice of the Femme Osage District, famously settling disputes under his judgment tree, claiming land and blazing Boone's trace. Boone hunted and trapped the Niguana and Osage, and Marmaton, a little Osage branch, Gasconade, and the Merrimix tributaries, clear to the expat Shawnee towns. Samuel Coles saw him on the Lamine. He caught two beavers. Their skins were worth $9 at St. Louis. A warrior band of hide hunters, Sacks maybe, nearing his winter camp, forced him to hide for 20 days, kindling fire only at night to cook. He never felt so much anxiety in his life for so long a period, he told John Mason Peck, an early biographer. Beaver was king. To harvest them, a typical mountain man, a company man, say, from the firm of Smith, Jackson, and Sublette, toted 6 heavy hand-forged double-long spring traps. Boone packed no less than 12. Stephen Hempstead watched as the colonel, his son-in-law, and Derry Coburn, Dan Morgan's teenage slave, landed his wide, fur-laden canoe draped in bear hides to shield a fortune in peltry from the sun and rain at St. Charles's Wharf. He landed first the stern, and the stern's man got out, and then the bowman rowed her around to not disturb the cargo, the middle being full and covered. Flanders Calloway and the Negro rowed in front, and Boone steered in the river. The value of their furs and skins was considerable. It was their practice to go by themselves or with Negroes every winter to hunt, even after their friends were opposed to it. And Boone, I should suppose, to be 80 years of age or upwards. Osages spied him nearing the Kansas border with Dan Morgan, Nathan, and Derry. The Boones got 900 beaver and considerable otter, fleshing out the beavers and saving their casters for the perfume trade and for lure, and lacing their skins on willow hoops. They pulled the case-skinned otter fur side out down the narrow stretcher boards, planed thin and tapered. Once dried, they bundled the furs in half-grained bear skins and buried them. After the Boones trapped on down the Berbouse, the Osages raised a cache with 100 lush pews. A year later, the tall, proud Osages, shaven heads aglitter with sterling earbobs and tawny with ocher and bear fat, and crowned with flamboyant yellow and black porcupine-quilled roaches, saw the aging buckskinned deer slayer astride a pony, alone but for the black teen who fled as they charged, jerking Boone from his saddle and out of his capo and acting as if to whip him. When they reset the ramrods, Boone put Darren to cooking, as he and the Osages striking flint and steel for their cantlinite disc pipes, palverage by sign. He knew what they wanted. After filling their bellies, powder horns, and shot bags, the Osages scarfed up the pelts and left, one of them in his new blanket coat. Boone backtracked to unearth a tiny cache of DuPont and stubby finger-long lead bars to run the big 66-caliber balls he used and trapped on, hunkering by day, kindling fire by night. That spring, he packed home 200 beaver. The Boones now lived west of their original Spanish grant with Nathan on Femme Osage Creek. In 1813, when Rebecca died, Daniel moved 20 miles to La Charrette, Marthasville, beside his daughter, Jemina Calloway, and her husband, Flanders. La Charrette's meat-getters took native wives and hired out to fur mogul August Choutreau, its blended community offering, said Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, the last Anglo society before Santa Fe. Wrote Clark, May 25th, Friday, 1804. Camped at the creek called Charrette above a small French village. Settled at this place to hunt and trade with the Indians. People at this village is poor, houses small. They sent us milk and eggs. This is the last settlement of whites. 2 years later, the Cour Huzade, the French village Cheriton. Saturday, 20th September, 1806. Saw cows on the bank, which caused a shout to be raised for joy. French and Americans expressed great pleasure at our return and acknowledged themselves much astonished. We were supposed to have been lost long since. Neither man mentioned Boone, nor did Zeb Pike when he visited July 1806 to dine with Joe Chartrand, La Charrette syndic, and his Osage wife. From this redoubt, the cutting edge of America's frontier, Boone launched his last hunts. His knowledge of the West was vast. Besides local hunters, he knew James McKay, St. Charles's syndic. McKay's treks bisected Canada to the Rockies. He canoed with Hudson's Bay. He mapped the Missouri to the Dakotas. Lewis and Clark used his maps. Senior pathfinders Boone and McKay surely swapped notes on the West, the day's most urgent topic. Territorial Governor Clark was Boone's friend, as was John Coulter, the renowned core hunter Manuelisa hired to go to the Tetons. Coulter mustered at La Charrette with Nathan's Rangers, and Nathan named a son for him. Forrest Hancock, who trapped with Coulter, then pushed past the Platte with Joseph Dixon and Pierre Menard, lived a mile away. Daniel Boone visited Forrest's father from Boonesboro, William, whose land bordered his son's. Wade Hayes said, "Grandfather Boone learned about the West from talking with Indians, like the Shawnees, who ranged to the Three Forks of the Missouri and beyond," Bernard DeVoto describes in Across the Wide Missouri. He visited Jimmy Rogers' Shawnee town near the Merrimack to hunt with his native brothers of old and reminisce. Nathan hired Rogers' sons for army guides. Charles Indian Phillips, who ramrod whipped Simon Kenton in Ohio land and captured Daniel in Kankakee, became his far west campmate. As I write in The Hunters of Kentucky, the old hunter's grandchildren remembered Phillips as being tall and spare, and that he wore Indian leggings and moccasins and walked and acted like an Indian. All were afraid of him, maybe. But for old Sheltowee, Boone's adopted Shawnee name, feeling his age and rheumatism, and the worries Kentucky wrought a fading memory, Phillips and Shawnee was the perfect comrade. Boone had hunted the Missouri past Kansas, maybe to the Platte, and knew what lay past it. He had kith and kin, a Shawnee and slave for camp hands, and La Charrette's hide hunters to contract with. In 1890, historian Lyman C. Draper, the State Historical Society of Wisconsin's secretary, corresponded with Wade Hayes, Boone's great-grandson, who wrote that Boone and his father, William Hayes Jr., hunted the Yellowstone from 1808 to 1809. Colonel Daniel Boone, William Hayes Jr., Derry the Negro, and several others were along. Started in the fall of the year and returned, spending one whole year and two winters hunting. Went near the junction of the Yellowstone and perhaps the Clark and Lewis Rivers. Had good luck. Got some Mackinac boats and started homewards with the furs. In the act of landing, Indians attacked them from the river. Thinks they were Snake Indians and landed and camped for the night with sentinels. But they were followed no longer. Indians robbed the beaver traps and leaving their traps, hoping to repeat the procedure. In recalling this episode of 82 years before, Hayes names people and rivers, Mackinac boats, tribal affiliations, times and seasons. Adding to his credibility, his tale is told simply without bombast or romantic nuance. But his dates conflict with factual events in Boone's life that occurred within the same two-year span. Like, 1. Daniel, William Hayes, and Derry Coburn, trapping near now Lexington, Missouri, came upon an Osage hunter who, through sign language, invited Boone and his party to his camp. Darting ahead as decoy, the Indian alerted another 20 or 30 warriors who charged, forcing Boone's party to gallop off, leaving traps and peltry behind. 2. Boone, beset with Scrofula's fever, oozing neck sores and lymphatic swelling, was in St. Charles under the care of Dr. John Jones, husband of Daniel's granddaughter, Minerva, who was treating his lesions with calomel, a mercury-laced balm. 3. During his medical stay, Daniel dictated his memoirs to Dr. Jones so that his own words might be left in the hands of a true and trusted friend, penned strictly in accord with his dictation. Jones was later murdered by rustlers who stole Boone's manuscript from his buggy. 4. Boone wrote to Judge John Coburn, formerly of Kentucky, concerning his land claims. 5. Boone petitioned the U.S. Congress for remuneration for his loss of 10,000 acres. Other issues. Snake Indians, a loose grouping of Bannocks, Shoshones, and Goshutes, rarely fired on armed Americans and bypassed the Yellowstone, land of the Blackfeet and Crow, Northern Cheyenne and Arikara. Further muddling matters, biographers have bastardized Hayes's quote, cutting and pasting in unrelated stories, like that of George Stoner's, who got to the Big Sky Country, but without Boone, he says, to craft creatively skewed fabrications now in print. Draper shelved Wade Hayes' story. In truth, it was not new to him. He had corresponded years before with H.A. Logan Jr. about Boone's last and most noted adventure, the Yellowstone trip, with his late father, Henry. There were about a dozen in the company, Colonel Boone, Alex McKinney, Henry Logan, and others. They started July 1817 and returned the next summer. They were attacked several times. Indians besieged their camp, but a snowstorm came up and the Indians raised the siege. They were attacked again as they descended the Missouri and forced to anchor on the opposite shore. Boone ordered the company on board and they moved past the Indian camp. A great many valuable furs were secured. H.A.'s letter has it all, weather, dates, raids, and people like Alex McKinney, a La Charette hunter surveyor who served in Missouri's assembly. Draper doubted that Boone, at 82, was traversing the far west in the winter. Could it have been 1814? No, says H.A., my father served as a substitute in the War of 1812, so it was after that, probably the winter of 1815-16. He admitted his scattered fragments of memory seemed as faint recollections of a half-forgotten dream, confessing he had mixed up some of his father's hunts, the Salt River, the Grand River, the Osage, and Yellowstone expeditions. Draper told H.A. of his talks with Daniel Boone, who said nothing about the Yellowstone trip. If it did occur, it might have taken place in about 1814 while Indians were hostile, Draper mused, referencing the 1815 Portage des Sioux Treaty, William Clark and Ninian Edwards, governors of Missouri and Illinois territories, mediated with a dozen Midwestern tribes. The truce slowed raids along the Big Muddy and animated Western expansion while marking a step in the death march of Native lifeways. As I stated before, I told you all I knew concerning the trips in which my father accompanied Colonel Boone. I know nothing more that can be of interest and shall draw this reply to a close, H.A. said, ending his interrogation by mail. Draper tabled Logan Jr.'s story as he did Hayes's. Little of it pertained to the Yellowstone, and Indians harassed travelers up and down the Missouri. And Nathan and his daughter Delinda, he knew, distrusted Logan Sr.'s telling tall stories to inflate his role in Daniel's exploits. Draper never resolved the Yellowstone matter. Through it all, Nathan, though, in an intriguingly reliable source, though he omits key events in his father's life, maybe because it was not a selfie culture, and like Daniel, he loathed boasting. A clue to this tale's closure may lie in his own recounting of his father's 1816 hunt, verified in the Niles Register in an April 29th letter from the Missouri Territory, when Daniel and a noted woodsman by the name of Indian Phillips visited Fort Osage for 2 weeks. We have been honored by a visit from Colonel Boone. The colonel couldn't live without being in the woods. He goes hunting twice a year to the remotest wilderness he can reach and hires a man to go with him, whom he binds in written articles to take care of him and bring him home dead or alive. He left this morning for the Platte. Boone said he wanted to take two or three whites and a party of Osage and visit the Salt Mountains, lakes, and ponds and see the natural curiosities of the country along the mountains. The Salt Mountain was about 500 or 600 miles west of this place. From Fort Osage up Big Muddy and the Grand, they canoed in search of beaver, but Indians and French trappers had caught them pretty much out. When Boone took sick en route to the Platte, they paddled south to Fort Leavenworth, a day north of Kansas City, where he convalesced and met Captain Bennett Riley. Did this, his last far western trek, foiled by sickness, mark Boone's stab at the Yellowstone? Perhaps. Or did he get there? But Hayes and Logan got the dates wrong. Maybe. We all want that Alfred J. Miller oil of him and Coulter hunting grizz on the Yellowstone, or standing a kilter to Old Faithful's steam plume. Hands high, mouths agape. One day, maybe. His lost memoir he dictated to Dr. Jones will surface at Sotheby's and explain it all. Until then, the old hunter died in his 85th year at Nathan and Olive's, amid an unbroken circle of prayers and hymns, and holding Nathan and Jemima's hands until they heard him say, "My time has come." A triumphant end to an abundant life. A legend in his day and in ours. His indomitable spirit that sought new frontiers, that confronted hardship with courage, is the legacy left behind the America's original pathfinder and longest hunting long hunter, Daniel Boone. Ted Franklin Ballou is a prolific frontier writer and 2021 WWA Spur Award winner, whose latest book, Finding Daniel Boone, His Last Days in Missouri and the Strange Fate of His Remains, was published in September 2020. True West, May 2022, The Beehive State. Utah has been a leader in apiary science for crop pollination and honey production for over 150 years. Honey is nature's sugar, and enterprising pioneers in Utah knew that. So they started beekeeping, which became popular in the 1870s. Mr. A.F. McDonald shared his thoughts on the subject. In 1870, he told the Deseret News he believed investing in honeybees for home consumption was good for many reasons. He noted that sugar dependency could go down, and if enough bees were imported, honey could be exported. He noted, "I got 30 pounds of honey from two swarms of bees, and this is only a small part of what can be done." In 1872, the Deseret Beekeepers Association was formed, and various other bee associations formed over the years. By 1880, the delicious nectar was being harvested across the Utah Territory from bees imported from the East, as well as from European countries like Italy. In 1882, beekeepers met in Salt Lake City at the Territorial Beekeepers Convention, and men from all around the territory presented their honey production results. Some hives produced as little as 90 pounds to as much as 3,000 pounds. Other topics included how cold weather and brood disease decimated some hives. Neffie Miller was one of the many beekeepers in Utah, but his company is the only one still in operation. He started Miller's Honey Company in 1894 when he traded 5 bags of oats for 7 bee colonies that began his legacy. He also served as the president of the Cache Valley Beekeepers Association for several years. Neffy's sons continued the business, and it's still being run by his descendants. The Millers, along with the Gambers, invented the honey bear container in the 1950s that's seen everywhere today. Eileen Miller, a fourth-generation owner, told me, "Growing up, and to this day, we never used sugar. Honey was used for everything that needed a sweetener." In 1897, honey had become a Utah commodity, and the state Senate debated on whether to approve funds for a state bee inspector. Some senators were in favor of it to stop the spread of brood disease, while others argued it was an unnecessary regulation. Some claimed, if approved, beekeepers didn't have to use the inspector, but could if they asked for an inspection. Senator Evans argued that a bee inspector was as important as a liquor inspector to ensure poisons did not go into the product. The Daily Tribune in Salt Lake City reported, "Senator Kane inquired if people were not as likely to be injured by eating honey from diseased hives as by drinking poor whiskey. No one replied to his question, and the decision was postponed until the House acted." By the late 19th century, merchants knew that beekeeping was a good business. Firms like Whitney and Pierce in Springville offered beekeeping supplies. They advertised, "We are now making a specialty of manufacturing beehives and do it in first-class shape." G.W. Mickel in Provo did the same and noted, "Quality first class and priced the lowest." The Salt Lake Herald ran a story about the various uses of honey per the American Bee Journal. They noted that honey was used for making candy, pastries, cakes, jellies and jam, canning fruit, curing hams and other meat. They also noted that it was used to make drinks like mead, cocktails, as well as vinegars for medicinal uses. Utah restaurants served the golden nectar with cakes and muffins, and bills of fare served honey with griddle cakes, biscuits, and waffles. Recipe: peach and honey cocktail. 1 tablespoon honey. 1 wine glass of peach brandy. Combine in a small bar glass and stir with a spoon. Serve in the wine glass. Recipe from the Bartender's Guide by Jerry Thomas, 1862. True West, May 2022 edition. Cattle Queens, Dragoons, and Rangers by Marshall Trimble. Question: how were Old West hotel rooms heated? Carolyn Childs, Houston, Texas. Fires were a menace to those wood structures. They could wipe out an entire town. By the 1820s and 1830s, coal was quickly becoming a dominant fuel type. It revolutionized indoor heating. Iron furnaces or stoves helped. Also coming into play in the 19th century was steam heating, which first appeared in the 1850s, but gained popularity in the 1880s. This was another form of coal heating, as coal would be used to heat the water, turning it into steam. Question: was Etta Place really Cattle Queen Ann Bassett? Jean Smith, Boise, Idaho. Linda Womack, author of the award-winning biography Ann Bassett, Colorado's Cattle Queen, says, "Ann never claimed to be Etta. She loved to brag, and believe me, if she was Etta, she would have eventually said so. Ann was never in Robber's Roost. Elza Lay's wife, Maud Davis, was there and knew both Ann and Etta. When Butch, Sundance, and Etta sailed for Bolivia, Ann was on her way to Texas. When Etta was in South America, Ann was fighting for her fiancé's estate in a Rout County courthouse." Question: was it possible to combine different parts of firearms during an era when mass production was still in its infancy? Greg Williams, Apache Junction, Arizona. Yes, it was. French gunsmith Honore LeBlanc suggested that gun parts be made from standardized patterns in the mid-1700s, so all gun parts could be easily replaced if broken. He wasn't the only one, but it was American Eli Whitney who popularized them in the first years of the 19th century. He used relatively unskilled workers to produce large numbers of weapons quickly and at lower cost, making replacement of parts infinitely easier. Question. Can you tell me about the life of an American soldier on the frontier in the pre-Civil War period? Udo Zindel, Stuttgart, Germany. The life of an 1850s American soldier on the frontier posts was mostly boring and dreary. Many were Irish immigrants escaping the Great Famine in their homeland. Discipline was harsh and desertions were common. Alcohol was a problem. But the biggest dangers were the dreaded diseases that spread through the forts. Sanitation was terrible. People were not aware of germs. At Fort Mojave during the 1850s, an average of 2 soldiers a week died of dysentery. They were treated with opium, quinine, lead, bismuth, and ammonia. Meals were lacking in nourishment and generally poor. They included hash, stew, baked beans, salt pork, coffee, and bread. Soldiering was similar to penal servitude, and conditions were far worse than today's prisons. Enlisted soldiers were generally viewed as lowlifes and scum or outcasts. Question. Were there rangers in California? Jack Townsend, Los Angeles. In the Old West, rangers was a term used to describe civilian groups like militias. In most cases, they were never a true police force. They were not necessarily trained or deputized. There were Rogers Rangers in the French and Indian War, Mosby's Rangers in the Civil War, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and even New York Rangers. They were also Forest Rangers, Game Rangers, etc. Question. Are there any stories about women ranching in the Old West? Joe Staley, Beloit, Wisconsin. The Bassett sisters, Ann and Josie, are probably the best known. They ranched for years in Browns Park, a favorite hangout of the Wild Bunch that straddled Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. One of my favorite books on ranch life by a woman is Ranch Wife and Mountain Cattle by Mary Kidder Rack. Mary was a graduate of Stanford University who married an Arizona cowboy named Charlie Rack. They bought a ranch in the Chiricahua Mountains of Cochise County. She turned out to be as good as a cowboy as her husband. Also, Ranch Women of New Mexico celebrates an icon of the American West from a female point of view. This book features 11 women who have cowgirled or owned ranches in New Mexico.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.